Good morning. This is Laurie Mercier. I'm speaking with Desiree Hellegers, Professor of English and affiliate of the Collective for Social and Environmental Justice at Washington State University, Vancouver, and one of the Mole Reporters producers in the Old Mole Variety Hour Collective. They have recently completed the second in a two-part web episode of How I Learned to Breathe Through the Apocalypse, which they describe as a surreal, hallucinatory black comedy set entirely inside the playwright performer's head, based on journals written by Hellegers during a 30-day Shambhala Buddhist meditation retreat in December 2005. Hey, Desiree, great to have you on the other side of the mic to talk about this hilarious series.
Thanks for making time to talk about it. I really appreciate it.
Well, tell us about this web series and what inspired it.
Well, so I went on this 30-day silent Buddhist retreat in 2005. Katrina had happened in August. This was December. I had spent some time in the West Bank in the spring. And there were so many disclosures happening about torture at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and Bagram. So much US military violence happening. And George Bush, the younger Bush, had at one point very recently referred to, the war on terror as a crusade. We were seeing so much evidence of the climate crisis accelerating. And I felt, as I think we all do right now and in moments of crisis, like I really wanted to entertain myself. I really wanted to be distracted. And I felt like it was a critical moment to kind of confront whatever the noise is that we run from in our own heads perpetually. And so I signed up for this extended Buddhist retreat. It was just a pretty surreal experience of sitting in nearly total silence for 30 days with only what's called functional talking and kind of Dharma talks in between. There was something I would consider almost like a hand ballet, a thing called orioki, which is a practice that you do, when you're eating and cleaning your dishes, and you're never ever getting up from the cushion to do that, right? So other retreats I'd been on, you get up, you'd have lunch, you'd have kind of a stress break or whatever. And in this case, it was much more of a powder keg emotionally and some ways physically, I guess, as well, because you were sitting so continuously doing walking meditation as well. But there wasn't a lot to kind of break that tension. And I had been on a week-long silent Buddhist retreat earlier. I'd been on a Catholic retreat for a week that was silent back in the 80s. But it was my first experience, I think, of having fairly vivid flashbacks to moments in the past, being hit with kind of a barrage of pop culture memes and fragments and all of the kind of texts that sort of make us up as human beings, and that we are generally disengaged from all of that noise that's floating around in our heads. And I think we're looking for ways to quiet it with more noise. And so I think extended silent retreat of this kind kind of allows you to have to confront that. There's just no way of getting around it. And I ended up having some very vivid flashbacks to traumatic experiences that I had in the past. And that's kind of the center of the second episode, how I accidentally killed my father, which flashes back. And I think of it as like time traveling, like Billy Pilgrim and Slaughterhouse-Five, that we mentally are often time traveling. It looks like we're both sitting here, we're occupying the same space and moment, but in fact, we're constantly flashing back to other moments in our lives and other experiences that we've had. And in this case, I time travel back to the 1940s, where my father was a child escaping the Nazi invasion of the Netherlands in the 1940s, and then sort of travel forward to the 1960s, where I am consuming tons of American cultural junk food while watching villages burn in Vietnam between commercials. So I think I was very much preoccupied by war and by the way in which we're drifting toward fascism in the US.
Well, it seems to me the title itself, How I Learned to Breathe Through the Apocalypse, is both a critique, as the play and the performance are, I think, both a critique of the military-industrial complex in important ways, but it also appears to critique the meditation-industrial complex as well. As you were saying, you're at this retreat supposedly to get away from war and the growing fascism in the United States, but you're also unable to have all those images that we're constantly bombarded with escape. So you grew up as a very devout Catholic, And that's apparent in the performance. And so, in addition to the Buddhist influence you referenced, you imagined your life as becoming a saint, or how you might dream of becoming a saint. So tell us more about that portrayal in the play.
I went all the way through, grade school, high school, Catholic schools, Catholic university. I went into the Jesuit Volunteer Corps. I was on a reservation in Montana where they were in the process of covering up clerical sexual abuse. I began to get some sense of the kind of colonial violence that the church had participated in. And I saw a huge amount of racism that was still practiced by the clergy, the disengagement from the poverty in their midst. And that really was my breaking point in many ways with Catholicism. But I still end up spending a lot of time with radical Catholics in Seattle. And I ended up meditating and being introduced to Buddhism by folks there with the Catholic worker who had been down in LA and had begun meditating at the LA Zen Center. So my real entrance into Buddhism was, oddly, these kind of Catholic Buddhists. I don't think they necessarily were, identified with the hierarchy of the church on any level, but their social justice work was still animated by a lot of those principles. So I guess in some ways, the series is sort of taking some of that skeptical lens that I honed as a kind of post-Catholic and applying them to some of what I was witnessing in this Shambhala Buddhist retreat. And, Shambhala would go on to have. Shambhala had some really troubling history with Chogyam Trungpa, had some really troubling behavior. There was kind of a history of sexual abuse of, Shambhala teachers going back to the 1960s. And then it erupted again in another wave with Chogyam Trungpa's son in about 2018. And so I found myself really thinking about the ways in which master-disciple relationship can really, set us up for all kinds of abuse, but the way in which it's also inextricably linked, in my mind anyway, to other forms of authoritarianism, right? So that really struck, of course, I think we all are now probably by so much of the kind of right-wing Catholicism that seems to be shaping the decisions of the Supreme Court. And strangely, I kind of look at this play as interfaith dialogue of sorts between Catholicism, Christianity, and Buddhism. I might be wandering far afield from your question.
Well, you, in addition to exploring faith and the impact of faith and spirituality and meditation on your life, I think it's the second episode of the series that you explore the impacts of your father's death on you as a teenager. And what is the larger story you're trying to explore about the intergenerational impacts of war and fascism?
I'm going to wrap back for a second to your earlier question, too, because I think there is a kind of spiritual materialism that all of us can fall prey to in whatever spiritual tradition we're in, right? Where we kind of fetishize some level of spiritual attainment. And in the context of, Catholic sainthood, it's like being the star of the show. You get to be like, Bernadette in the Song of Bernadette.
So magnificently did Jennifer Jones interpret the part of Bernadette, the peasant girl in Franz Werfel's The Song of Bernadette, that from the moment this great motion picture was first publicly presented, there was no doubt that it had given the world a new, incomparable star.
Or you're like St. Francis and Brother Sun, Sister Moon, which is like one of my favorite films growing up. So all of these pop culture influences are also kind of in dialogue with these spiritual texts and practices. But, specifically with my father, who was also devoutly Catholic and remained so throughout his life, to me, and I don't want to kind of give away the circumstances of his death, but he definitely suffered from malnutrition and from other kinds of medical or health traumas, partly as a result of being a child refugee of the Nazi occupation of the Netherlands. And, my father had a lot of health issues in his life that were, to me, directly traceable to the effects of fascism, of militarism, of war. And in 2015, I actually went on a delegation to Vietnam with Veterans for Peace and learned that 50 years after the American war in Vietnam, more Vietnamese people had been killed by unexploded ordnance in that 50 years than American GIs died during the war. And so, to me, it's war explodes across decades. It's never over. When it's over, And, the US now has this long history of using weapons that contaminate the landscape of these countries, possibly in perpetuity, right? Especially without serious remediation. And the US has, never paid reparations to Vietnam. And we know that the US has left, all this depleted uranium in the Middle East. And we know that in Iraq in particular, they've seen many of the health effects in children being born with terrible disabilities in the same way that we're also seeing in Vietnam. And so, I think the other thing that the series tries to do is kind of name names. So these corporations have names, right? We know in the aftermath of the Holocaust that there were so many American corporations that collaborated, right, to create that industrial scale death. And my family was incredibly fortunate as Catholics, having money to be able to flee, to be able to get to England and be taken in as refugees. And so many, certainly, Jewish refugees, other refugees, queer LGBT folks who just would not have been greeted with those same open arms and as a result died in the camps. So war is never over when it's over. It's like a timed release bomb that's always going off, and that affects generation after generation. And I couldn't even produce this segment with images of, we've got some images in there of children, child refugees being fed at feeding stations by the Red Cross or whomever in those war zones. And I definitely was thinking of Gaza in that, right? We're seeing so many health effects of children in Gaza and so many tens of thousands of people who've been killed and so many children who've been orphaned.
It seems to me that just recently, the mainstream media, in fact, I just heard something on NPR, expressing some horrors of the utter destruction of Gaza, as if they had not been aware of what massive bombing U.S. bombs have done for the last 15 months. And as you say, the long-term effects, so people are horrified by the rubble, but not thinking about the environmental consequences, the health impacts, not to mention the actual people who have been killed, but the many more who will die in the future from the inability to access adequate health care. And for the past 25 years, the United States has basically destroyed the Middle East without achieving a single political objective. So I think that's a powerful part of your web series, How I Learned to Breathe Through the Apocalypse. But one thing I love about the series are the somewhat sarcastic references to popular culture. What are some of the pop culture touchstones that you decided to integrate into this production and their relevance to the more serious subjects explored, especially the Vietnam War?
Especially in the first episode, I mean, there's some stuff about, I think it's DuPont, right? These old kind of clips of DuPont from the 1950s or 60s, Better Living Through Chemistry kind of song and dance.
Better things for better living through chemistry for the finer world we want.
Knowing the incredible damage that Dow has done to Vietnam and the destruction of triple canopy jungle and the ongoing health effects of Agent Orange. So those kind of clips seem to me deeply ironic. I mean, I think we were talking earlier about how creepy one of the Barbie ads is.
If you had Mattel's Barbie in some of her new outfits, just think of the fun you could have together. You can tell she's Mattel. She's swell.
Barbie becomes kind of this recurring figure, and also the Sound of Music, right? Because as a Catholic family, as refugees from the Holocaust, that film always really resonated for me. But also the Brady Bunch, right? Marsha, Marsha, Marsha. I mean, I felt like I went through a couple of days where all I could hear in my head while I was trying to meditate was like, Marsha, Marsha, Marsha. These kinds of earworms that get in your head and they're rumbling around in there in ways that we're not even conscious of until you sit down and sit in silence and can't escape them. But I think to me, when I look back on the Brady Bunch and I think, where was the Vietnam War there, right? I mean, where was the episode where Greg burns his draft card? Where was it? Was like the war was completely erased from so many sitcoms that I grew up watching and all of this. And then we would see the violence of the war on the news, but without any kind of frame for understanding that. I sort of reimagined some of those sitcoms kind of later on in the play. But I also just want to say something quickly about torture too, because those disclosures of torture at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, I think in the series really kind of picking up on the ways in which fetishization of torture, right? The image of the tortured Jesus that so many of us kind of have pounded into our heads, where there's a kind of fetishization of torture, but it's so disengaged from those of us who are white in the US or middle class, comfortable. And I have questions about what does it mean to believe in a torturer God, right? How did we become in the US so steeped in the logic and rhetorics of torture? And I think that is inextricably linked to kind of faith in a God who's a God of torture. So I think in some ways, I'm sort of teasing out some of the worst of these traditions, but also wanting to celebrate the best of them. And I did end up taking refuge vows as a Buddhist on Christmas Day, which seemed very, very appropriate to me. But I also direct a lot of skepticism toward people taking bodhisattva vows and promising to come back lifetime after lifetime to address suffering. And there's a part of me that's like, wait a minute, hello, I'll give you a ticket to Iraq right now. You don't have to wait till the next lifetime. If you want to have that experience, you can have it right now. And that's kind of some of the skeptical critique that's going through my head, because I do think that we have so much wealth and privilege and are so disengaged from the incredible suffering that our tax dollars are meting out in so many places, but certainly especially in the Middle East. And then we're sort of simultaneously getting spiritual cred for imagining ourselves as kind of peace agents. And I don't want to get too cynical here, because I do believe that in the best of these traditions. And I think it's really important right now that we do have interfaith dialogue, and that for those of us who are Catholic or come out of that tradition and see the ways in which Catholicism is being really weaponized on the Supreme Court, politically in the US and globally, that we need to be able to talk to other people and try to make space for a different kind of spirituality, one that is possibly much more based in the actual words of the Gospels if you're coming at it from a Christian tradition.
To break away from the hypocrisy that becomes unbearable at times. Mm-hmm. And Desiree Helgers, thank you so much for sitting down with me today to talk about this amazing production. Folks can find it on the web. We'll link to the Open Signal website on the Olmo Variety Hour webpage. This is Desiree Helgers' web series, How I Learned to Breathe Through the Apocalypse. Do you want to say anything more, Desiree, about how people can access this?
You can go to the tinyurl.com/5AUV4UZB. That's tinyurl.com/5AUV4UZB. And I do want to just do a shout out to my two amazing collaborators, Melissa Salazar at Open Signal Community Media Center and Daria Ruggles. So shout out to these amazing collaborators, without whom this wouldn't have been, certainly would not have been possible.
Well, again, we'll link to the web production at Open Signal on the Olmo Variety Hour website. Thanks again, Desiree.
Thank you, Lori.